everyone, I'm Brandon Odo.
And I'm Brian Bowling.
And this is Critical Care Scenarios, the podcast where we use clinical cases, narrative storytelling, and expert guests to unpack how critical care is practiced in the real world.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back to the podcast. I am your host, Brian Bowling, and with me is my co-host, Brandon Odo.
You.
We often forget in the ICU that things exist outside the ICU, and patients leave the ICU and hopefully go back to their regular lives. And sometimes we think of it like flipping a switch, right? That the ICU stay is done and they're back to normal. And it's not always like that. And rehab is an important part of critical care, and we probably don't talk enough about it. So we're going to take some time today and talk about rehab and the psychological effects of critical care. And so we have a special guest with us. Megan Hosey is an assistant professor and is a rehab psychologist in the division of PM&R, physical medicine and rehab medicine, at the Johns Hopkins Hospital in Baltimore. Clinically, she practices in the MICU there, and she does research with ICU patients and looking at rehab and the psychological effects. So welcome to the podcast.
Thank you so much for having me.
All right, Megan. I'm going to tell you about a patient in the medical ICU, which, you know, a particular sort of patient, but I think not a totally unlikely one, something that probably a lot of us have come across. And I think a good example of some of the topics that I'd like to get into today. This is a 51-year-old female, and she was living independently and actually working before she came to the hospital, although she does have morbid obesity, as well as a diagnosis of obstructive sleep apnea, obesity, hypoventilation syndrome, a little bit of HFpEF. And she's admitted to the hospital for shortness of breath, found to be hypercarbic. They put her on BiPAP. Her diagnosis is a little bit vague, thought to be a sort of multifactorial respiratory failure. You know, probably a lot of it with roots in her obesity, but she probably is a little volume overloaded. Maybe she has pneumonia. It's hard to know for sure. She gets diuresed a little, but she really, for a couple days, doesn't make much progress, unable to get off the BiPAP, and eventually gets intubated because she's just not making any progress. She spends about 5 days on the ventilator, just being optimized to whatever extent possible, and then is extubated, and does, again, kind of so-so. She's kind of on and off requiring BiPAP, and then gets a little worse, and 3 days later ends up re-intubated. The cycle kind of repeats. Eventually, she's extubated again, makes it a couple days, gets re-intubated again. This last time before she's intubated, when she's able to talk, you know, have a conversation with her that, you know, if we're intubate again, really what we're talking about is probably going towards a tracheostomy and probably a PEG tube. There's a feeling that, you know, this actually may address some of her issues, her OSA, help her with her OHS, give her an opportunity to kind of improve her functional status, get stronger, lose some weight, and should be eventually able to wean because there's really no underlying medical disease that's not treatable here. So she gets trached, and we fast forward 3 weeks after her tracheostomy. Her progress since then has been inconsistent and kind of back and forth. They're trying to wean her on the ventilator. Ideally, she would have left the hospital, but they've been unable to dispo her because mostly a kind of series of typical low-grade ICU problems. You know, she has a little AFib here, maybe another pneumonia there, things like that. She's certainly been delirious on and off, at times overtly and sometimes probably more subclinically. PT and OT have been seeing her, not making a whole lot of progress. A lot of days they'll go to see her, and she turns them away, just doesn't really feel up to it. Speech therapy has been seeing her too, but kind of a similar deal. She doesn't always really want to work with them. Sometimes they're trying to wean her on the ventilator, and they do some pressure support or put her on trach mask, and she'll ask to go back on the ventilator after, you know, maybe kind of minimal efforts at weaning. She seems to have kind of a depressive mood, sort of just a flat affect, pretty withdrawn. You know, the team is not really able to assess as much, both because she can't talk a lot of the time with the trach, and honestly, it's just not really their area of expertise, but there's some talk of maybe we should put her on an SSRI or something like that. And it just seems like she's not really making a whole lot of progress, and hey, there are probably some psychological factors to that. So I'm curious, from your perspective, we usually consider these cases, as most of our cases, just from the medical perspective of the clinical team, which really is focused on, of course, the acute issues. What are patients like this experiencing from their perspective? What are the, you know, what are the things that they're feeling and experiencing? And, you know, how does that play into the course of their actual illness? Because I think it's really, it's kind of a black box to us. We don't really know. We can guess, but we're just not in a position to really understand what's going on for them.
This is such a great way to frame this up, because you're right. This is not an uncommon patient, somebody who we think might get out and has several setbacks and is with us for much longer than we would anticipate. And there's not always a lot of time built in to hear from the patients about what their experiences are like. Fortunately, now, because patients are surviving critical illness longer, we do have research on some of the psychological outcomes, and patients are given the opportunity after discharge in a lot of our qualitative studies to tell us what this is like. And so based on spending time with the patients and what we see in the research, I think one of the first things that you touched on that is extremely important to consider is the patient's experience of ICU delirium. ICU delirium, as you guys probably already know, is hallmarked by inattention, which means that it's really hard to clock where you are, when it is, who's around you, and what's happening to you. And so for several of our patients, this can look like, I have no clue, this was a total blackout time that I don't remember, all the way to, I had hallucinations and delusions where medical procedures became acts of torture, became really scary situations, and where the patient has a really hard time engaging with the medical team because, for example, like I had a patient tell me 2 days ago, my husband had to help me because I thought my nurse was just a head on a skateboard roaming around the room. So this is some of the really basic thing that we have to pay attention to, which is that what's their cognitive status and how are they perceiving their intensive care unit stay? And I think you've talked to other folks. I will try not to get into the ABCDEF bundle and the ways that we try to prevent and manage delirium, but that we do have some research on what we think is helpful there. Once the patient is able to be awake, alert, and maybe consistent periods of not being delirious, we know that mechanical ventilation and other procedures can be highly anxiety-provoking, especially when we take some of the elements of hospital care that are not unique to any hospital but ubiquitous to all of them, which is make them uncertain when, why, am I going to need this? And there's really never a clear answer for most of our patients. And that's where anxiety tends to live, is what is the plan and how are we going to follow through on it? And finally, you mentioned depression. Depression can set in for patients, as you mentioned, who've been hospitalized for a long time. And it also might be better characterized as hospital demoralization. So if we take any human being going about their life, working as your patient was, and put them in bed for prolonged periods of time without regular access to the things they love and the things that matter, there can be a sense of helplessness, hopelessness, especially when there's not an easy plan to get out. So I think that these are some of the things that the patients are talking about with regards to sort of negative affect and negative psychological outcomes.
I think the majority of the audience has probably never even heard of rehab psychology. Fill us in a little bit. What is this specialty even, and what is practice like yours end up looking like, and like what's the role you play with patients like this?
clinical psychologists might choose this specialization, which is usually acquired through a postdoctoral fellowship. And what rehabilitation psychologists do are partner with patients who've usually acquired an acute illness or a new injury and help them find meaningful ways to adapt to life in the wake of new illness or injury. There's a lot of ways we do that. We talk to patients about health behaviors and how to manage illness and injury. We talk about values and priorities to make sure that people are finding pathways back to the things they love and the things that matter. And we often have specialized training to assess cognitive changes and health behaviors changes that usually accompany new, illnesses and injuries.
It sounds like more of something that would play a role when a patient is, you know, leaving the ICU or the hospital. What is your role in the medical ICU?
So you're right. Typically, I get a consult for patients who are awake and alert and having difficulty engaging in their rehab therapies. I'm also consulted for cases just like the one that you described to me, where patients just are describing not feeling like themselves or sort of missing home. We often get consulted in cases where patients have treatment refractory delirium to talk about how can we modify the environment to keep it safe for the patient and for the staff. Those are some of the sort of hallmark consults that I tend to get. We sometimes consult with family members, particularly if the idea of rehab is new and counterintuitive to them, which it is for a lot of folks. I'm vented and on ECMO and you're telling me I'm going to do what? So we are additional support to the teams for explaining why that's important and how it can happen safely.
Are rehab psychologists available in a lot of centers? I say even for inpatients in general, but it's certainly in the ICU, or is this kind of a unique thing?
So this is country specific. In the US, we do not have a lot of psychologists working in intensive care units. You can find us in consult services at high-end academic medical centers. You can also often find us on inpatient rehab units where accreditation standards for rehab often include psychological support or a psychologist in their accreditation. So that's here in the U.S. In the U.K., people like Julie Highfield and Dorothy Wade are psychologists who've advocated for policy to ensure that psychologists are part of the staff in every ICU across the U.K., they're a little bit more common in places like Germany and Brazil too.
So, you know, for a patient like this, this patient you could argue is not even really acutely ill anymore. They're kind of in the middle ground. Jack Iwashino likes to call this persistent critical illness. I think he's at your institution now. It's kind of its own phenomenon, and I think we often struggle with it. So, we talked about some of the psychological factors that the patient may be experiencing. But from the medical perspective, obviously our focus is on how are we going to heal them and get them out of the ICU and make them better. How do the psychological factors play a role there? I think the one that we often perceive to be true is a motivational barrier. Like the patients are not able or willing to participate in the things that need to happen to get better. And if that's true, we don't know what to do about it. What's your take?
So yeah, what does this look like when you have a rehab psychologist on staff, for example? I think in these instances, which again are highly common, when I get involved, I do a basic assessment with patients, which sounds like a really technical way of just saying I get to know who they were before they came to the hospital, make sure that they have enough cognitive bandwidth to be engaging with us around motivational interview or motivational issues, assess what they think their barriers are, and then we start to work on a plan that gives them not only a way to maybe reduce negative affect or things like this, but also increases a sense of meaning while the person's in the ICU. Yes, you're very, very sick, and you're also still alive. So how can we build in the things that matter to you? And this is where teams have done miraculous work in the wake of the humanizing critical care movement to just do spectacular things. And I do think that we can see movement and some progress with engagement with patients when we build in the stuff that matters to them. And I'm happy to give more examples of what specifically I'm talking about there, but I don't want to ramble at you too much.
Yeah, no, I'd like to get into some practical things, but I guess I am curious because, at least from my perception, so much of the work that you do as a psychologist generally involves speaking to patients. It seems like it'd be difficult with a lot of these patients. Some of them can't speak, right? I mean, if they have something like a tracheostomy, they may or may not be able to speak in that setting, depending on some of the other details. Of course, some of them may, if they have some sedation or other things going on. But I mean, how much are you able to engage in these conversations, or are there a lot of barriers that sometimes make it kind of impractical?
We, fortunately, thanks to people like Mary Beth Happ at Ohio State, who put together the Speaks to Communication program, my speech language communication colleagues, the SLPs, we can usually get around some of this. The other team member who become really important here are the family members. Using alternative forms of communication like whiteboards, eye gaze, yes, no's, instead of open-ended questions, and then family input for patients who are lucky enough to have that, we can usually still put together a plan, especially after we've just sort of normalized and validated how difficult this can be. Often, just in the hustle and bustle of the day, I might be one of the first providers who can talk to a patient about, you're not feeling like yourself. Of course, you're feeling a little sad, down, anxious. This is a really, for most people, unpredictable and unexpected situation. So communication barriers can be a problem, but usually we can overcome them.
I want to get into nitty-gritty stuff here because you were all hard-headed clinicians here. And, you know, the team is sitting around, they have this patient like this, and they're saying, look, what do we do with this lady? She's not making any progress. And again, you know, I don't want to relegate what you do to like touchy-feely stuff, but sometimes people who are focused on critical illness, they're really focused on the physiology and the things that tend to kill people. And that absolutely applies here. You know, patients like this die from not getting better. And of course, if you're not getting better, you're getting worse. Despite the fact that, you know, someone like this has the potential to recover. I mean, she doesn't have end-stage cancer or dementia or something. Essentially, her problems arise from kind of a functional level, which can be healed, but also has the potential to not get any better until she just stays on the ventilator, acquires a litany of hospital complications, and then never recovers. So it's the need is very practical. But what do we do? You know, what are steps we can take to help this patient actually move towards recovery instead of the other direction?
So there are several ideas that come to mind and might be low-hanging fruit for patients who have chronic critical illness, who we don't think are, you know, regularly delirious and not able to engage with this. What this often looks like in our ICU is first trying to set up a schedule for the patient where the day becomes as predictable as possible. So OT at a specific time, PT at a specific time, and then if there's any routine procedures, things like dialysis or your vent lean, sort of knowing exactly when those are going to happen. We then next try to build in pleasurable activities. So the fancy psychological term for this type of intervention is called behavioral activation. At its core, what it means is when we get people to do things that are pleasurable and meaningful to them, it helps them, it creates a positive spiral where they're able to do more and more. So for our patients in our ICU, this looks like we have a core set of things we do. Sunshine therapy means getting outside, talking about animal assisted therapy where the dogs come in and have their visits. We have two music programs. One is Sound Rounds, which is the Peabody Music Institute here at Hopkins sends in trained musicians who play at the bedside. And we also have Carrie Devlin, who is a trained music therapist who takes requests, does things like record heartbeats, and then plays preferred music over the top of the patient's heartbeat. And uses specific techniques to sort of help manage mood. You'll have folks like me coming in to talk about relaxation strategies. And in fact, we've had several patients who we can use their vitals as a biofeedback mechanism so they can sort of monitor how their heart rate changes or how their breathing rate changes when they're relaxed versus when they're very stressed. And also just basic education and validation about how difficult these processes can be, with motivational interviewing about how taking control over the things that are in your control, like engaging with nurses around pericare, doing the rehab therapies and things like this, that combination or set of additional things can sometimes help people move in the right direction.
It sounds like a lot of those tools may be things that, you know, could or could not be available to people in different settings. You know, some of it depends on your infrastructure and other services and things. But some are, and some, of course, you can find. I mean, if you don't have a music therapist, you could still perhaps ask the patient, you know, what music they might want to hear or something like that.
100%. In fact, Linda Klein at Mayo Clinic was able to demonstrate that just asking a patient what music they want to listen to and for how long reduces anxiety levels and sometimes the amount of sedation that they need. So that is a very easily accessible tool in most spots.
Yeah. And is the idea of trying to give them a schedule just that it reduces anxiety when they can kind of predict what's going to happen? And even if they can't control all of those things, they at least know what to expect and it's less, things are kind of less surprising.
Yep, that's a big part of it. And I think it also just induces a sense of normalcy. Our days probably had some sort of a routine to them. We get up, we eat breakfast, we know the route to work and how long we're going to be there approximately. All of this is what, especially like the patient you described, this is what their life was like before they got really sick. So making things a little bit more predictable and routine is just how human beings kind of like to be a lot of the time.
Do you find that there is a is an important role of the patient's own control over their situation? I mean, there are so few decisions that patients like this are able to make. We're mostly doing things to them. But do you think that if you're able to give them back any even small amounts of decision making over what's happening, it provides some, I guess, kind of reassures them that they're still able to do that. I mean, you know, saying no to therapy, for instance, it may be one of the few decisions they're able to make in their day.
100%. I think that that is spot on. I think that correlation also deepens the longer the patient is there with us. So you're right. We've sort of anecdotally found simple choices like, do you want to do PT at 9 a.m. or at 1 p.m.? Do you want to... what are some other common things people have control over? Do you want to do your fees or your swallow test? Usually people are pretty eager to do those so they can get back to eating. But, you know, same thing. Like, what time, what flavors are you hoping for? Exactly. Just, I mean, even with breathing trials or vent weaning trials, do you want to go as long as you can go, or do you want to try to set our time for today? I think all of these are really helpful. And we've also, along with that, like making things super concrete for patients, So yesterday you weaned for 2 hours. Can we shoot for 3 hours today? And having like a chart on their whiteboard showing their progress. Some of these things can really help as well.
You know, most, like I said, most centers, I don't think have any psychologist who will come to the ICU. And I really think that split is usually pretty profound. I mean, we talk about silos sometimes in medicine, but the people who take care of dying patients, I think typically have very little ability or maybe interest in engaging with psychological considerations. And the people who do often seem to have no interest in coming to the ICU. If you don't have a psychologist, most hospitals have a psychiatry service, but usually they're like, if you try to consult them on a critically ill patient or even someone who's kind of getting better and they're trached or something, they'll often be like, I mean, what do you want me to do here? And there may be, I mean, you know, sometimes there's a social worker or somebody else who kind of falls into the category of like people interested in talking to patients, but still there just doesn't usually seem to be a lot of overlap in critical illness and people who can grapple with this stuff. So, I mean, what should we do for those of us who don't have, you know, resources like yourself, someone who is both an expert in critical illness and in psychology, you know?
I think that there are some toolkits and conversations that are helpful. You mentioned dying patients. So I would suggest people check out the Conversation Project, especially they have several sets of questions that are open-ended that are really helpful for talking to patients and family members about what they're hoping for in the end of life. And the nice thing is that they ask in a continuum. So for example, you know, there's a continuum where some people want to know everything about their treatment process and their prognosis and what's likely to happen from the doctor's perspective. And some people say, I don't want to know any of that. Just talk to my family. You know, where are you on this continuum? And these are easy ways to sort of nudge yourself into these conversations. And I would say that would also probably be part of my assessment and intervention with a person like the one that you've described. Even though we hope she's going to survive and we have a prognosis that looks like it could move in the right direction, knowing these things about her, for example, before she had a major setback or things like that would be helpful for family and team probably.
Do you think there's a role for medications in treating patients like this, whether it's treating symptoms of anxiety or depression? Obviously, these are things that are done in other settings. And I think sometimes we talk about it in our setting because it's kind of one of the few tools that we are comfortable with using or at least know about. But it's also, you know, such a blunt instrument to respond to these sorts of things. And we can't even really engage with the patients and a lot of these other levels. It's just also just not really our area. So it often probably feels like you don't really know what we're doing and maybe doing more harm than good. How should we kind of think about this?
About medication. So yeah. I will just be on the record that as a psychologist, I'm a non-prescriber.
Sure.
So take the things I say with a grain of salt, but a couple broad strokes. We know that benzodiazepines can feel really good in the moment, but for critically ill patients, are often likely to cause more complication than they are to be helpful in the long term. So, you know, we know that they are more likely to be associated with delirium. They actually are associated with longer term PTSD symptoms for patients who do survive ICU. And we know about that in the treatment of anxiety, we kind of know that they're not that great a long-term solution for anxiety anyway. It's sort of like going to your primary care doctor saying, I'm really anxious. And they say, well, just go home and have a drink to take the edge off. You know, we know that the benzos kind of have the same root as alcohol and the same sort of performance in terms of anxiety reduction. So those are not a first-line defense. For people who have more chronic critical illness situations, who do describe symptoms of depression, helplessness, hopelessness, worthlessness, guilt, these types of things, that SSRIs might be helpful just to give people a little extra lift. during this period of their life. And then certainly for delirium, I would defer to my critical care colleagues who know way more about, you know, antipsychotic medications or things like that for the treatment of delirium. But we know that for patients with a lot of agitation, things like Seroquel can sometimes make things safer for patients. So those are the broad strokes. I don't say never. And I think sort of getting a sense of and thinking really strategically about how is this going to look for a patient in the long term? Is this a med they're going to be able to maintain and that's going to ultimately pay off? You know, I think that those thinking about the long term is really helpful in those situations.
Yeah. I know you're not a psychiatrist, but is there any research in this area, like pharmacotherapy for things like anxiety or depression in this sort of a setting? Because it seems so different from, you know, the outpatient setting where most patients are being treated. But
there's not a ton. Joe Bienvenu is a psychiatrist here at Hopkins who is fantastic, but also has done some of the work here in that realm. So I would sort of defer to his work there. And certainly there's been a bunch of really effective trials looking at delirium prevention and management so I would defer to those trials as well. But yeah, I think medicating people in the ICU for psychological symptoms is an understudied area for sure.
And yeah, and delirium obviously plays such a big role in these patients. And these patients, even who have been around for weeks or months or whatever, do you still find that a lot of them are describing delirious kind of symptoms? And if so, are there any strategies they can use to manage that? I mean, I can imagine someone who's, you know, whatever, thinks they're being abducted by aliens or something, that's just going to be like an anxiety provoking sort of thing. I mean, I guess you could tell them, hey, you know, it's not real, but I don't know if that's effective.
Yeah, unfortunately, you know, the major treatments for delirium and cognitive impairment are going to be environmentally based. So what I mean by that is it's going to be kind of on the providers and the families to sort of structure the environment in a way that's going to be helpful. So we do sometimes recommend gentle reorientation in the context of conversation, you know, Ms. Smith, you're here in the Hopkins ICU. Today is et cetera, et cetera. And now that it's lunchtime, we will blah, blah, blah. So all of that is sort of in the context of conversation and not beating people with the info. For people who have an agitated delirium, we actually recommend a little bit of a different approach, which is has been termed in memory care facilities and things like that is join the journey. Other people who are improv comics talk about it as yes and. So rather than tell your patient, you know, in fact, we're not in a bar and no, you can't have a gin and tonic, you might say something like, well, the floor is really cold, so let me get you something, and you hand them a glass of water, for example, are some of the more sophisticated ways people have helped with things like that.
Oh, interesting. So you don't feel like playing along with a delusion, it worsens it or causes problems.
If it's not super scary. So I would not play along with a delusion, for example, where a patient thinks they have an IV drip that's a snake. I would say something like, well, we're going to protect you from that, so let me move it for you and get rid of that snake. I think that, you know, I would give lots of reminders of safety and calmness and removing the scary object. But yeah, I wouldn't necessarily, around things that are less scary, I don't necessarily challenge it. Because it's not, the patient's so inattentive that they're not likely to be able to register like, oh, you're right, I'm in the hospital.
Okay, yeah. So they don't go, oh, geez, what am I thinking? Yeah, I'm not really in a bar. You just start to argue about it.
Sorry, I was just going to say, I think that's really interesting to hear you say because, you know, I was always taught that always, you know, want to reorient people. And outside of a school learning environment, I find that that's super ineffective, right? Because you end up just arguing with someone who is not rational. And, you know, when I worked in the emergency room years ago, there was one of the paramedics who would say, I always play along. It's so much easier, right? If somebody says that they're from Jupiter and they're on their way to see the president, I go, great, let me take you. And it's so much easier than trying to convince him otherwise and then getting into a fist fight with the guy. So
I guess it's about, is it possible, right? If they just forgot where they are and you can remind them. But if they're like delirious and they, you know, cannot comprehend it, then what's the point?
I think arguing with delirious patients generally not something we want to tend towards. And we've had a couple of scenarios where there are specific cognitive interventions where you like say the date and the time and you try to get the patient to repeat them back to you a certain number of times. And I've had patients come back to me and say, like, I just said what they wanted to hear. I don't really believe it. I still think I'm at Mercy Hospital and not Hopkins, but I know that's what they wanted to hear. So I think gentle reorientation, if it seems to soothe people, especially for people who are brand new to hospital. I mean, I can't tell you how many COVID, during like the height of the pandemic, I can't tell you how many COVID ICU patients I would see who didn't have memory of being brought to the hospital and were just sort of waking up without any context and not, you know, thinking that they were in labs being experimented on or any other number of things. And so for those folks, giving them gentle sort of, it makes sense that you don't remember this, but this is where you are and where what you've been through so far. For those folks who had no awareness of just showing up in the ICU, for them it was helpful.
Yeah, it's like if you view and understand delirium to be, you know, a medical process, then it would make sense that it's not, you can't argue it away. I mean, if somebody's hemoglobin is low, you're not going to say, "Hey, what's the matter? You're not really low." It is what it is. You just have to kind
of gave you iron. Yeah,
yeah. You have to treat the problem, let it go away, and then you can try to get them back to normal. You know, compared to someone who just, you know, they forgot what's going on or something like that. But all right, Brian, what other questions do we have?
You know, what you were saying about normality, I think is really important. I tell patients all the time, particularly patients that are in the ICU. I work in a surgical ICU and a neuro ICU. So in the surgical ICU, a lot of our patients are, you know, they're actively rehabbing, right? They came in for a planned procedure that happens to land them in the ICU. And, you know, we have a plan, right? And I think that's very helpful when I sit down and I say, okay, today this is what's going to happen. And tomorrow this is what's going to happen. And I often use the phrase, you know, we're going to get you up, we're going to get you walking and acting like a normal person. Because I think that the more we get them into their sort of normal routine of, you know, it's not normal to lay in a bed all day. Even when you're sick, that's what I tell patients too. Like, even when you're sick, even when you have the flu and you stay home from work, you don't just lay in bed all day, right? You get up and you make yourself some food and you sit and watch TV or maybe you read for a while. You try to do some things. And I think we lose sight of that in the hospital.
Yeah, I think our day-to-day of seeing patients maps on 0% to their day-to-day. And often people have no context for hospitals to sort of understand, like, what is the flow and why don't I ever know what's, you know, when I'm getting a procedure, things like that. So I think you're totally right. Just normalizing, validating, giving people opportunities to get back to their normal selves. And I would say, too, that there are a few guidelines starting to emerge that might be helpful for two things. One is, like, getting some of this stuff that we're talking about today baked into medical curriculums so that, you know, trainees are sort of more aware of this. And then, two, maybe positions for being able to advocate for more mental health care within these intensive settings. So for example, there are for level one trauma units, there are a set of guidelines that do recommend proactively screening all trauma patients for acute stress disorder and PTSD, because we know that those rates are really high. And if you're at an institution where you can say, like, look how high this is, you might be in a place to say, let's bring in some psychological supports to improve the outcomes for these patients. If you're in a medical center where you're training trainees in trauma-informed care models, for example, that sort of bakes in some of these concepts that we were already talking about today.
Well, Megan, what else do you want us to know about this? What should we leave people with, especially those who are, again, you might be the last rehab psychologist they ever hear from?
I mean, I think I would just want them to know that I'm really grateful that there's people who are curious about how to maximize our outcomes for patients and how to sort of make life in ICU meaningful, even though it is really challenging for people. So that gives me lots of hope, just the fact that we're having these conversations. I think it plants seeds for the future, and just be thinking about what little changes you can make to your usual practice, just based on making things feel more awake, alert, oriented, and normal for patients. I think you're already doing a great job, especially in the context of the fact that you're keeping a human being alive. I think that that's really, really important to focus on. So we can't have psychologically healthy people if they are not alive. So thanks to everybody listening.
Any resources that you think would be useful to people going forward?
Yeah, so I mentioned a few things. So the Conversation Project is a really cool website that talks about designating a healthcare proxy and end-of-life questions. I would definitely check that out. There are, of course, you know, your staples, the ABCDEF bundle, something we always want to be thinking about for critically ill patients. The PADIS guidelines also, I think, are going to be really important psychological supports for patients. And finally, if you're interested in what the heck does a rehabilitation psychologist do and who are they, you can check out Division 22, Rehab Psychology of the American Psychological Association. And that talks a lot about our field and gives you a sense of what we do.
All right. Well, we'll let you go there. I'm really glad you could join us today. We'll just remind everyone that these have all just been our own opinions, not those of our respective institutions, and really just meant to be general educational content, not specific medical advice. And we will talk to you next time.